10 plus 10. And we have until 10:50, right? So we only have 40 minutes.
Let's see your lecture.
No, no, I'm kidding. So I guess I'll go all the way until 11, right? Because we're starting late today. So you probably know my name. I'm Freddy Cachazo. My office is 450 in the other building. And this week, we are going to be talking about string theory. In fact, you're going to be talking about string theory for the next 6 weeks, OK? And you're going to get, I think, 4 different perspectives from 4 different people. So that's going to be great. Very good. So you probably have 2 textbooks on your desks. Well, only one, but right. But I would also recommend Green, Schwartz, and Witten, okay, and Polchinski. That's very, very useful textbooks. Now, most textbooks in their introductions, they would start nowadays by saying that a string theory is a nice theory. They would start with unification and the paradigm of unification. But I would like to make the point that unification is something that we didn't always have. And in fact, it's something that was forced upon us by experiments. Okay? So let me start. Going back to electricity and magnetism, okay, in the second half of the 1700s and in the first half of the 1800s. Okay? So we had electricity and magnetism. These were 2 different theories. Okay? But then people started to realize that by experiments, one was related to the other, and you couldn't make sense of one without having the other. Right? So by the end of the 1700s, people had the equations and everything was working fine. But there was an inconsistency. What was inconsistency? Do you remember? The inconsistency that Maxwell solved, and that's why these are called Maxwell's equations. Does anybody know? Yes, yes, indeed, yes. He introduced the displacement current. Very good. Now, Maxwell was able to resolve an inconsistency. OK. So he got his equations. What was the prediction of having the full equations all consistent with each other? What was the main prediction he could make? Sorry? Excellent, yes. Electromagnetic waves. So inconsistencies lead to new theories, or better formulations of the theories you had. And this leads to predictions. OK, very good. So now we had a beautiful theory there. But now there was an inconsistency again. What was inconsistency? Maxwell's equations were inconsistent with what? Excellent. With Galilean relativity. What was the resolution of the inconsistency? Special relativity. OK. First of all, the inconsistency here, if you forget about magnetism and you only study electromagnetism, and putting everything together led to the first unification into what we call electromagnetism. Now here, special relativity. Did we get any unification out of special relativity, out of this inconsistency, or the resolution of this inconsistency? Was there any unification? Excellent. Yes. Anything else? energy and matter were unified. So that's great. Now, we had a special relativity, and how about Newtonian gravity? Was that consistent with a special relativity? Of course not. And what did we get out of that inconsistency?
GR,
excellent. Okay. Now, more or less at the same time, there was another big inconsistency, right? Can anyone remember what the other big inconsistency was at the beginning of the 19th century? Yes? Even before, people realized that there was an inconsistency, right? Well, with the experiments of Rutherford, people realized that the atom had the structure of a big positive charge nucleus and electrons going around, right? So was that an inconsistency or not?
You'd have expected the repelling force from electromagnetism to blow the positive charges apart. You wouldn't expect them to be thrown together like
No,
that.
Well, people knew that you can form bound states, right? So there are the electrons, and at the time they could have thought that the nucleus was only just one particle, say, of positive charge. Yep. Was there any inconsistency with that? And yes, we knew that there were electromagnetic waves and there was radiation. And this led to what? This would lead into the decay of everything that we see very rapidly. So that was a terrible inconsistency. And how was it resolved? Right, with quantum mechanics. Excellent. Very good. So now the question is, who thinks that string theory came out of an inconsistency? Just like all these wonderful theories came out of inconsistency or puzzles or crises in our understanding. Who thinks it came out of an inconsistency? Raise your hands. OK, one. Let's see. Who thinks that it didn't come out of an inconsistency? OK, like six. And there is a third possibility. Yes and no. So I would assume that the rest of you think that the answer is yes, no. So okay. So this is one of these very few times when, if you didn't raise your hand, you were right. Okay, I'll try to convince you that the answer is actually this one. Yes and no. Depends on the point of view. Yeah. Okay, but was there any other theory? So this theory was developed in the 60s. Was there any other theory at the same time that was developed without experimental evidence, without having to do with any inconsistencies or any mathematical, any puzzle that was coming from experiments? Yes. Sorry? Well, the quark model, okay, you could think about that. In the strong interactions, there was an SU3 flavor symmetry, and then people wanted to understand that. But even before that, in the 50s, well, let me remind you that in the 50s, people understood very well that electromagnetism came from a U1 gauge theory. Okay? So what was the generalization of that? Excellent. So Young and Mills, without any experimental input or anything like that, they decided to study generalizations of this to non-abelian gauge groups. Okay? The most famous example is SUN. Okay? Now, was this a crazy idea at the time? What do you think? Why was it a crazy idea? Yes, but even worse. This was completely crazy to do. Complete waste of time. Let me tell you why. In the 60s, the only massless particle was what? The photon. At the same time, people were making experiments studying the strong interactions. And what were they finding? Yes, but they didn't know. So what they were finding was tons of massive particles. OK? So doing this was completely crazy. Because every one of these particles here, you had n squared minus one of them. They were all massless. So that was just an academic exercise, completely crazy. No experimental motivation. That was called mathematical physics. Not even physics, perhaps. Because this is what you had to do. You had to understand this. Now, not only was this what was happening, but also people realized that the masses of these particles were going like their spin were proportional to their spin. And they called the proportionality constant alpha prime. Now, what is the spin? Well, you have to classify the particles somehow. And the way to classify them, if you have a theory that is Poincaré invariant, can anyone remind me what the Poincaré group is? OK, very good. So do you know what the trick is to classify particles according to the way they transform under the Poincaré group? Yes?
You can get representation of the Poincaré group by doing, you know, it's the semi-direct product of the Lorentz group and the translation group. And you know how to find representations of Lorentz group. So you can use induced representations, like that machine, to get representations of the Poincaré group. And they end up being classified by, like, the orbits of points in the Lorentz group. So, like, every hyperbola, every, like, mass hyperbola in Lorentz group becomes, like, there's one family for, you know, time-like things, and one time-like for space-like things, one for light-like things.
Okay, indeed. So if you have the momentum, which is part of the algebra, right? If you take the momentum square, that commutes with all the generators, and that means that that's a good eigenvalue. So the mass of a particle is a good way of classifying the particle. Okay, so you have the mass. Any other way of classifying the particles? Well, does anybody know what a little group means? No? Okay. My friend Nima told me that he told you everything about little groups. I don't know what's happening. Yes? Okay. It's a sub-excellent, so you're in the right direction. So if you have a particle moving with some momentum p, okay, now the trick is to look at the subgroup of the Lorentz group which preserve that momentum p. Okay? Now, if you have a massive particle, you can do something very easy. I can ask you, well, suppose that you are the massive particle. I can go to your rest frame and ask, what's the subgroup of the Lorentz group that leaves him invariant? What do you think it is? Okay. All the rotations. Okay? So for a massive particle, we have rotations in three dimensions, okay? Special orthogonal transformations in three dimensions that preserve him. Okay? Assuming he's a point particle, right? Because they wouldn't actually preserve him the way he is now, right? But that's fine, okay? Now, how do you classify? As an algebra, SO3 is the same as SU2, which you're very familiar with. And you know how to classify states under the way they transform under SU2. What's the way you classify them? Yeah. That can take values, which values? OK? Does this stop? Well, that's something you remember that somebody told you once, right? But that's for massless particles. For massive particles, I'm telling you, people were discovering lots of particles, right? So, well, for J, just as a mathematical statement, does J has an upper bound? No? Goes all the way to infinity, right? Now, when people were making these experiments, they realized that this thing was going, they were finding one after the other. So there was no reason to expect that this was going to truncate, right? So they found a puzzle, what seemed to be a puzzle. Infinite number of particles. Now, why is that a puzzle? So I assume that you are all experts in computing Feynman diagrams, right? If I give you a scattering amplitude, you will be able to compute it immediately, right? So can anyone tell me what this Feynman diagram is? Suppose this is a scalar field theory, OK? And the particle propagating here has mass m. Can anyone tell me what the contribution of this Feynman diagram is to the scattering amplitude of these four particles? 1, 2, 3, and 4. Excellent, that's true. Very good. So this was a particle with a spin 0, OK? Now, you're also experts in scalar electrodynamics, right? You also did that. So you will be able to tell me what happens if the particle that propagates here has spin 1, like the photon. So how do I modify this? Here?
Yeah.
No, that's always the mass of the particle that is propagating. Oh, you're saying I should remove this and just have s. Is that what you're saying?
No, s minus p squared. How far off shall the momentum conservation of the propagating photon?
No, you see, this is a three-level diagram. This s, let me remind you, this s is given by the momentum of the particle 1 and the particle 2 squared, right? The sum of those momentum. What's the only modification to this? I'll give you a hint. Of course, if this was a photon, this would be 0. But let's keep it to be massive, because at that time, we only knew about massive particles. So what do we have to introduce? Sorry?
E squared.
What is
it?
The charge.
Oh, well, yes, okay. The couplings and so on, yes. Even here, we had to introduce the couplings, but let's forget about that. Remember, if these are scalar particles, and this is a vector particle because it has spin 1, right? The interaction has a derivative. Do you remember that? In the Lagrangian, it has a derivative. So the interaction vertex has a derivative. Therefore, it carries momentum, right? You got two of those, so they will contract, right? So there is something here in the numerator which carries the dimensions.
The metric tensor.
Well, turns out to be T. You know what T is? The other Mandelstam variable, right? Remember, this comes from the contraction indices of these interaction vertices. They carry a power of momentum in the numerator. Each of them carries one power of momentum. Therefore, the contraction gives you something that has dimensions of two powers of momentum, and it turns out to be T. Okay? Now, following the pattern here, so let's say that you have T to the 0, T to the 1. What's going to happen if you have a particle with spin J propagating between these two particles of spin 0? we're going to get T to the J, okay? That means that this contribution to the amplitude is going to be the sum over all these particles propagating between these scalar particles, and this is going to be an infinite sum according to our assumption, where the mass is related to the spin in this form. Now, is this a contradiction or an inconsistency?
Well, if we're saying that mj is proportional to j over alpha, m squared is proportional to j over alpha, then that's going to diverge. Right?
Well, it depends on the value of t, right? So, as a sum, it's not a divergent sum. So you would say, perhaps it's fine. Perhaps this looks fine. Now, the problem is that, first of all, we know that in quantum mechanics, you have to make loops out of these things. So this is a way of making a loop, OK? Well, if you want to follow the pictures, this is a way of putting two of these diagrams together. And if you do that, now you will have to sum over the whole set of momenta running here. You have to integrate over all possible momenta. And that will include the momentum t here. And when you integrate and you go to regions with large t, what's going to happen to your sum? Now it's going to give you very bad infinities. Okay, so this will give you very bad infinities. There is also something wrong with this formula here. We know that if you have an amplitude that involves just bosons, yes? Okay. You know that if you have just an amplitude that involves only bosons, you should also include some other diagrams in this computation, right? You should also have a diagram that looks like this, okay? A diagram in the T channel, as it's called. That's what we do with Feynman diagrams. We include this term in order to have what? We need to guarantee that we have what? In Feynman diagrams, crossing symmetry, right? Very good. So we will also have to include another infinite sum here, and that would be terrible, again, for the loops, okay? So we were given this puzzle, or people at the time were given this puzzle. And what did they do? Well, somebody had a crazy idea, another crazy idea. The idea was that, well, if this is an infinite sum, why don't we say that our amplitude that depends on S and T, okay, is indeed equal to T. To this with some coefficients. Okay? How about crossing symmetry? Well, the crazy idea was that perhaps this was also equal to this. Is there any way this is possible? This formula here doesn't have any poles at any location of T, or so it seems. And this one doesn't have any poles at any location of S, or so it seems. How is that possible? Any ideas? Sorry? They have T, sorry? Well, they should, right? Because if they are the same, they better have the same poles. But how is that possible? Well, If I give you something of the form, can this object have a pole? No? Well, can anyone tell me what this is? Can anyone sum this up? Well, it does have a pole at x equals to 1. Okay? So if you have an infinite series, you can have a pole very easily. So this was in the mind of whoever came up with this crazy idea. Okay? And this idea is called the duality hypothesis. Okay? So that the S matrix or the amplitudes of a strongly interacting particle satisfy this duality hypothesis was a crazy idea at the time, but it was something that was reasonable, especially because Veneziano when he was asked the same questions as I did now to you, he immediately came out with an answer. He said, well, but I know a function that does that. Well, he knew a function that had an infinite number of poles. That was a gamma function. Okay, and he knew where the location of the poles had to be. That motivated him to make a definition of this. Okay, where this was alpha prime. It's called alpha prime because you take one derivative of this and you get this number here. So you just call it alpha prime. Was the slope of this linear dependence, and this was the intercept. Now he said, well, you just take this formula, you plug this thing here, you expand in one way, you get this answer, you expand in another way, you get this answer. So he came out with the answer immediately. Okay. That was very amusing, and perhaps at the time he thought he had done everything, this was the resolution to the puzzle. Not only he found this remarkable formula, okay, which you will study today in the afternoon. So in the tutorial, you will learn much more about this function. But there was also something else that was remarkable. If you take this function, remember that I was complaining about the very large momentum behavior of this function, right? So what happens when you take the momentum S, sorry, the center of mass energy to be very, very, very large, these things were divergent. Or when you take T to be very large, these things were divergent. Or when you take both to be very large, you would think that you get infinities in loops. Now, when you take S to be infinity and T to be minus infinity, this is a very, very high energy process with a scattering with a scattering angle fixed. Guess what happens? Well, what happens is that this function becomes some function of the angle, just a function of the angle, to the power minus alpha s. So not only Veneziano was able to resum these things or to propose something that has this duality property, but also he found something that, without looking for it, was extremely well behaved for large momentum. It was so well behaved, it was exponentially decaying to zero. It was so well behaved that in the end, it was wrong. Okay, so sometimes very good things can be bad, depending on the point of view. So why was it wrong? Well, in the 70s, there were experiments okay? And these experiments show that precisely in that regime, you would expect only a power law decay. And this power law is the thing that gave rise to, or it was consistent with the partum model, in which you had quarks and gluons. Okay. Now everything was fantastic for Young and Mills, right? Because yes, with an SU3 gauge group plus quarks, you could describe everything that was going on there. Now, what happens to all these massive particles? How come that there were all these massive particles if the gluons are massless, according to Young and Mills? Well, also, at the same time, asymptotic freedom was discovered. And you know the rest of the story. Nobel Prizes here and there, and everybody's happy. Massless particles are starting to rule the world, OK? So massive particles are a thing of the past. OK, so that's great. Then massless particles started to be the start of everything with the electroweak theory and the big success of the standard model. OK? So I just would like to remind you that this is completely mind-blowing, right? Something that was just a mathematical generalization ended up being realized in nature. Sometimes we take these things very lightly. We say, oh, yes, Young and Mills came out with this, so this is a Young-Mills Lagrangian. But imagine, what are the chances that you're sitting at your desk, coming out with something, and that something ends up being part of nature? I mean, this is completely, completely incredible. So we should really think about this as an incredible achievement. And the fact that we have the standard model is also an incredible achievement. So this is, we are so used to this that we don't appreciate it anymore. But this is completely awesome. OK? OK, so what happened to our string theory? Well, or to our Veneziano amplitude? At the same time that everything was happening, people were studying this amplitude, and they realized something interesting. They realized a physical picture for why this duality was happening. The physical picture was very, very simple. The picture was that this amplitude was really computing the scattering of strings, some open strings, coming in, some coming out, OK? Two strings were coming, joining, doing crazy things, and then separating away, OK? Now, when you look at this diagram and you think about all the momenta as incoming, as we usually do in quantum field theory, right, to compute the scattering amplitudes, can you tell any difference between the S channel and the T channel? I can't. Probably you can't either, right? Well, Feynman diagrams were very different, right? In the T channel, we had a particle propagating. And in the S channel, we had a particle propagating in a different way. Somehow, this picture was unifying those two ways of doing Feynman diagrams, or those two different kinds of Feynman diagrams, into a single picture. So this was very nice. Yeah, yes? No, here, these guys. Oh, no, why did they put everything in? OK. When you do it in quantum field theory, so how do you compute a scattering amplitude? Right? So you know at a scattering amplitude, we usually take particles coming in and particles going out. But people realize that these scattering amplitudes were analytic functions of these momenta, right? And what they realized was something spectacular. If you take your scattering amplitude where you take particles 1 and 2 and scatter them, right? And you take that function as a function of the momentum and analytically continue that to the regime where, say, particle 1 and particle 3 are coming in, and particles 2 and particles 4 are coming out, you get precisely the same answer as analytically continuing this one to that region. Now you continue the analytic, you keep on doing that, and you find all possible processes of scattering particles 1 through 4 were, in fact, all related to each other. Now, since none of them is the most fundamental way of thinking about this, by convention, we choose to study or to describe all scattering amplitudes in the regime where all the momenta are incoming. Of course, momentum conservation tells you this is just a convention, but momentum conservation tells you that the sum of the PIs must be zero, right? So necessarily, one of them will end up being outgoing, right? But this is the usual thing that we do in quantum field theory. This is also something else we take for granted, but it's completely non-trivial, that just the same analytic function describes many different processes, OK? Sorry? Well, that's going to be the subject of, we will have to learn a lot in order to compute these amplitudes. OK, very good. Now, if everything is so great with the standard model, why are we still here? Right? Maybe we should go home and relax. Right? Can anyone tell me? Sorry? Excellent. Yes, so there is just this tiny little force somewhere there. OK. So what do we do with gravity? Well, people knew now very well that Young-Mills was working very well. Everything was fine. Now, gravity can be thought of, people realize that it can be thought of, or it's very similar to a Young-Mills theory. But now, a Young-Mills theory where you have a particle of helicity, or you have particles of helicity plus minus 2. Now, what's the little group for massless particles? So here we discuss the little group for massive particles. Do you remember what the, do you know? Well, depends. Do you know what the little group is for massless particles? Is that the same as? Now, remember that you now, you cannot go to the rest frame of the massless particle, right? Well, I'll tell you what it is, but today in the tutorial, you will also discuss this. And you will do it not in four dimensions, but you will do it for any number of dimensions today. OK? So I'll tell you what it is today here. It's just SO2. OK? And the helicity of the particle tells you how it transforms under an SO2 transformation. OK? Well, so fine. So if the theory is just a Young-Mills theory, let's go for it. Right? So if you take two particles, say our friends, two scalar particles, and you try to compute how they interact, you will start drawing your Feynman diagrams. OK? Where these are gravitons. Your gauge particles of helicity plus minus 2. But what's the coupling constant in this theory? Yes, I heard it somewhere. Somebody said something? Yes, G Newton, yes. OK. But is G Newton dimensionless? No, it's not dimensionless. So if we would like to weigh these things with a dimensionless parameter, what else can we write? So the only thing that we can do is to multiply this by energy squared. Okay? And this thing is given by this, by the ratio of the energy to the mass, to the Planck mass. Now we would say, oh, this is fantastic, because the mass Planck the Planck mass is of the order, what? 10 to the what? 10 to the 7. Very good. So this is incredibly large, right? Incredibly big. So any energies that we are used to, or any experiments we can make, have a fantastic coupling constant. It's almost the smallest possible one that you can ever imagine. So we're done, right? You would say, that's great. But then somebody can come and say, wait, wait, wait. But what happens if you somehow have a process where the energy is of the order of the Planck mass? Then your perturbation theory will break down, and there will be, this will not make any sense. You say, who cares, right? We don't make experiments at that energy, right? So we're done. Let's go home. But then somebody says, wait, wait, wait a second, but look at this diagram, right? Even though this energy wasn't that big, okay, you have to sum over a loop. And in the loop, you have to integrate over all possible energies, okay? So you will certainly reach this energy using quantum mechanics. So quantum mechanics tells you that you have to care about what happens in the UV, or how your theory behaves in the UV. So sadly, this doesn't seem to behave very well. So let me just, going back to our example, let's try to look at the contribution of particles with some spin, as we did before, when they run here in the loop. Remember that we have to define the loop momentum, say p, and we have to integrate over the momentum of the particle in order to compute a loop amplitude, right? Now we know what this was and what this was, right? This is a scattering amplitude we were studying before, right? Just tilted 90 degrees. So plugging this in, say this is a particle of a spin j, and this is a particle of a spin j, what do we get? Remember, we had t to the j, but t was p squared to the j, and we had momentum. I'm calling everything p here, because we're going to be studying everything for large p. So we don't care which one is s, which one is t. Let's just call everything that has dimensions of momentum p. In fact, we will drop the mass at some point, because everything we want, we are interested in the behavior of this for large p. Okay, so this can be dropped. And we have something like this. So we have one of them here and one of them here. So this thing goes like what? For large momentum, we want to think about this as something that behaves like this. You can easily check that that's the answer, right? Now, I put this lambda here. This is called a cutoff. We're integrating this up to that momentum, OK? And we would like to take that to be infinity. Yes?
Why didn't you put the coupling over that?
Remember, this is the effective coupling that appears in the diagram, right? So of course, there will be some G Newton outside coming from the interaction vertices, right? Now, what's the behavior of this? Well, if you have a spin zero, this is completely fine. It's not divergent. If you have a spin equal to 1, this becomes log divergent. But now you know you're experts in renormalization. You know that you can renormalize a theory that has log divergences. And this is precisely Jungmans, right? The non-abelian gauge theories. What happens when you have spins greater or equal than 2? Then you are in trouble. Then you have power divergences. And then you are in trouble. So you got an inconsistency again. Then people started to think, well, Higher spins, quantum field theory, they don't make much sense. We are in trouble with this. What do we do? Any ideas? Do you know any theory that behaves very nicely for large momentum? In fact, it behaves so nicely that it was wrong at the time. Yes, so we were precisely seeing that a string theory ended up giving you something that was behaving spectacularly well for large momentum. Now, not only that, it also had particles with any spin, very, very high spin, right? Okay. So can we use a string theory to resolve this problem? So we have the puzzle. Can we use a string theory? Yes.
You're talking about Veneziano's gamma function formula, right?
Yes.
But how is that a string theory?
Well, when Veneziano wrote it down, he didn't know it was a string theory. But it turns out to be the answer that you get. He simply wrote it down as a formula that satisfies the duality hypothesis. So people started to realize that this thing was actually what you would get if you were scattering classical strings, okay? And that's how it became string theory. In fact, it was called the dual model, right? Because that was what it was for. Later on, it was realized that it was a string theory. Okay. So imagine that we're going to consider this diagram in field theory, okay? This diagram in field theory is UV divergent, okay? In four dimensions, it's UV divergent. Now, how would be the computation in a string theory? You have a string that comes in, splits into two, and comes out. So let me ask something. How many of you are familiar with fluid dynamics in two dimensions? Okay. Do you remember that? Well, okay, so let me ask something else. How about electrostatics in two dimensions? So what's special about that? I remember when I learned that, it was so great because you had these difficult problems in three dimensions, right? And there was almost no way to solve them. It was almost impossible. But in two dimensions, there was something very powerful that you could use in order to solve many, many problems. Complex analysis, yes. And you could use complex analysis because there was something that you could do that was called a conformal transformation. Do you remember? You could translate a problem, okay, with some boundary condition into another problem. Say you wanted to compute the static fluid in some wedge, or you wanted to compute the electrostatic potential in a wedge. So you could use, if you were working in two dimensions, a conformal transformation to turn that into the problem of just computing it with just a line. Okay? The boundary conditions could be translated into something very, very simple. So two dimensions were very, very special. And I remember at that time, I always wondered, I mean, it's too bad we live in four dimensions. Two dimensions is so great. We can do all these many things. I didn't know that, well, there was actually a way of using that later on. And it turns out that the way to do it is because in a string theory, the theory lives on a two-dimensional wall sheet, right? Now, suppose for a moment and this is a big if. Okay? Suppose that your theory allows you to use conformal transformations. Okay? We don't know that the theory will allow us to do that. Maybe there is no way to write a theory, a relativistic theory that will give rise to something that allows us to use conformal transformations. Okay? But suppose, just for fun, just for today, that you are allowed to use conformal transformations. Then I'll show you a sequence of transformations that you can apply to these boundary conditions to turn this into something very, very nice. So the first thing we're going to do is to apply a conformal transformation that will send minus infinity, where the string is coming in, to a point. Okay? So this is going to be our particle that is coming in, our string that is coming in. And the string that is coming out is going to be mapped to infinity in the complex plane. And everything that is happening here, all the shaded area, is mapped into the upper half plane. Okay? You would say, well, but conformal transformations will not allow you to get rid of this hole, right? There is this boundary here, so this boundary must be somewhere. Well, yes, indeed, it's somewhere here. Under our transformation, we go to that problem. Okay? It turns out that there is another transformation, another conformal transformation you can make on this to turn it into something nicer. Where this hole goes into this hole, into this boundary here. This line here now goes into this line. The in particle is just a dot here, and the out particle, or the out string, is just somewhere here. Somewhere along this disk. Now this disk has to depend on something. It has to depend on the structure of the original diagram, right? And we are supposed to integrate over that. Well, that modulus that determines the structure of the original diagram translates into this radius of the inner circle, and we can always take the outer circle to be at 1, normalized to be 1. So we just have to integrate over R, the radius of the inner guy. Now you would say, well, perhaps the divergences in field theory, these UV divergences, will manifest themselves as what happens when R approaches the boundary values. What are the boundary values in this diagram? What are the dangerous regions? So we are supposed to integrate over R. So what do you think are the dangerous regions, the ones that can give us a divergence? 0 and 1, right? I don't see anything. Those are the only special values. So let's see what happens for R going to 1. So when R goes to 1, our object looks like this. And it's looking more and more and more like that, right? Now, by a conformal transformation again, we can rescale this that is going to 0, okay? This length that is going to 0, we can rescale it to make it 1. But once we do that, this length goes to infinity. Okay? So we're going to rescale this length that is going to 0 to normalize it and make it 1. And the price you pay is that the length or the radius of this circle is blowing up. It's going to be very, very large. Well, but that process is nothing but an open string propagating freely from minus infinity to infinity. So this is just infrared physics. Okay? And we all like infrared physics. That's fine. Remember, our problem is the UV behavior of the theory. But this is just infrared physics. Yes? Why not what? Well, remember, this was a disk, right? But since you're nice, I'm going to make you happy. So let's look at R going to 0. What happens when R goes to 0? Well, our disk, our annulus, is becoming a disk. Okay? So the radius is becoming very, very small. Now, by another conformal transformation, what we can do is to keep the radius. Here we kept the length, this length to be fixed, equal to 1, as we were taking the limit. Here, we can take any radius in this circle to be 1. Okay? We want to take each radius to be 1. Each radii will be 1, normalized to 1. So once we take the limit, when this thing goes to 0, what's the price we pay? Yes, so imagine this guy is normalized now to have radius 1. Okay. In fact, every radii, every circumference here is normalized to have radius 1. Therefore, once we take this to be very, very, very small, the price we pay is that we have to send it to infinity and what we get is something that is nothing but a closed string propagating from minus infinity to infinity. Well, that's the magic of the conformal transformation. Conformal transformations don't preserve the length. Okay? Now we see that, well, the only two dangerous places that this integration could have are, in fact, infrared physics. And not only that, we learned something else. We also learned that if we have a theory that has open strings, there is no way of avoiding having closed strings. OK? So I don't expect you to understand this now. This is just a motivation, just to show you why people always like to say that a string theory is a UB finite theory. Okay? And the reason lies in the magic of these conformal transformations, which allow you to take any dangerous region into infrared physics. OK, very good. So let me end by okay, tomorrow I'll give you the outline of the rest of the week. But today let me just end with a comment that was made in the 70s, which I think is quite remarkable because I think it's actually true. In the 70s, it was said by Amati. Remember, at the time, people were using this theory as a theory for the strong interactions, right? At that time, they still didn't know that this was going to be a theory that allows you to study gravity, quantum gravity, and unified gauge fields with gravity. But even at that time, Amati said that this theory was somehow a theory of the 21st century that just by chance was discovered in the 20th century. Okay. Tomorrow, I'll let you with that comment, and maybe some of you might think why that comment has a lot of chances of being true. Okay, so try to think about that. Why this theory would have been discovered? So the claim is that this theory would have been discovered in this century if it hadn't been at that time. Okay. So try to think about that, and we will continue tomorrow.